Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. Laura Kleppinger, who is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Utica University. We're, of course, speaking about her fascinating new book, Transnational Yoga at Work, Spiritual Tourism and Its Blind Spots. Laura, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Raj. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, there's so many, ways into this conversation. But perhaps you can tell me a thing or two about spiritual tourism, or how you mean it in this context, and set the scene for us a bit.
Yeah. So what I think about as spiritual tourism in this context is individuals from a lot of places on the globe, a kind of trend in this experience of people seeking out spirituality, broadly speaking, by touring, by visiting, right? By visiting another place. And truth be told, when I conceived of this project, I didn't necessarily go into it with the literature and the background in spiritual tourism in mind. I was interested in the ways in which India and yoga together were being represented as accessible for an audience who might not otherwise have partaken of yoga. And so in, you know, modern yoga studies as a broadly conceived field, is kind of my way into this discipline. But then I ended up working, as you'll know from the book, with the people who, for the most part, are not really part of that conception, right? They're just workers who are employed by this institution. And so this idea of spiritual tourism and its blind spots kind of encapsulates this idea that there are people going to India seeking out an ashram experience for their own enlightenment or self-benefit, and yet, you know, in many ways, totally missing the interactions with, you know, with a whole set of people that are not really conceived of as part of the search. I hope that's clear.
So your book is ethnographic in nature, and you are speaking with those perhaps in the margins, in the periphery, in the shadows, mm-hmm. who support, make happen the stage hands for the spiritual tourist performance, if you will. Yes?
Exactly.
What were those conversations like? How many were there? Tell us a bit about the research process.
So as an ethnographer, I came from pretty traditional background, the approach of, you know, participant observation. So I wanted to study and get to know primarily women, because that was more accessible to me as a woman, who work as cooks and cleaning workers at this international ashram in India. And over the course of several visits, I presented this idea to the authorities at the ashram and made, like, you know, quiet attempts to introduce myself to the women in the kitchen. And I don't know, by some amazing feat, I was granted the permission to do the work. And then the women accepted me to kind of work alongside them. So I didn't work the extensive day that they did. They would get there about 6 a.m. and leave about 4 or 6 p.m, depending upon the traffic at the ashram. But I worked a bulk of the day with them. And I sat on the floor in the kitchen, chopping vegetables, rolling out chapati, which is not a typical South Indian dish, but was something that we served at the ashram, and got to know them. And through that process, those conversations, sometimes they were about work and the hardships of their labor. Oftentimes they were about their home lives, their husbands, their children, grandchildren, their houses. Housing was a major source of concern for a lot of these very poor women who were employed by the ashram. And so just, you know, by being part of their community, because I did have the language background, so I was able to, at a certain point, I won't say I ever blended in. I'm a white American woman with a, you know, I was nearing my PhD, and there were a lot of things to separate us for obvious reasons, but we did develop close friendship. And I really just got to know about their everyday lives.
Perhaps we should clarify for the listening audience, which institution is this? Which ashram is this?
Oh, it's the Shivananda Yoga Vedanta Centers, which is an international institution. They were founded in North America, and part of, you know, how I framed my project was that this was the first ashram in this wide international institution that was in India. So it was after their founder and guru, a man who they call Swami Vishnu Devananda, after he had started many different ashrams in North America and Europe, he had the opportunity to open another international ashram in his home state of Kerala, which is in South India. And so that's where I based the majority of my research. I did smaller, shorter term studies in some of the centers, which are like urban yoga centers where people come for daily classes, in Chennai, in Thiruvananthapuram, which is also in Kerala. And in Madurai, there's a small ashram that was newer that I spent a little bit of time in.
Just prior to us diving into a bit more of the nuts and bolts of your book, one wonders, what drew you to this work? Was there a particular interest question in mind, or was there a backstory? What's the sort of genesis of this line of research? Yeah.
Well, in my case, the backstory is kind of important because I came to yoga, in my youth, early 20s, I was a dance major in college, and had an interest in India and was studying Bharatanatyam. I was taking classes in Indian poetry and Hinduism. I was very interested in Indian philosophy and a lot of different aspects of Indian culture, broadly speaking, and had the opportunity. A professor of mine had done a teacher's training with this organization, Shivananda. And so that's really how I got my start. She recommended I do it because she said, you know, that's great to be able to teach yoga as a dancer. And you seem to be really interested in all the philosophy and everything. So you should give it a try. So that was my initial kind of foray into this organization. And then I studied and taught with them for a number of years before making my first trip to India and visiting this ashram. And what happened for me was that I was struck by the two different populations that existed in the ashram in India that really don't exist anywhere else in the Shivananda organization. Because from its founding, the organization is based on this idea, which is shared across lots of different similar institutions of karma yoga or selfless service. And so pretty much everywhere in the world, the people running the ashrams and institutions, the people doing the cooking, the cleaning, you know, everything from scrubbing toilets to, you know, running the you know, registration and checking in guests was done by people who were actually themselves practitioners of yoga and you know, considered this as part of their selfless service. But in the Indian ashram, there was that population of karma yogis, broadly speaking, who, you know, who taught classes, who did the administration, but they weren't the ones cooking and cleaning. And so that was in 2000, so long, long time back, more than 20 years ago. Now I go to India for the first time, visit this ashram, and I'm like, who are all these people who are clearly not, you know, they're not attending yoga classes, they're not in the morning meditation, but they're here and they're working, and there were quite a considerable number at the time of my my research, which was 2009, 10, 11. There were about 70 employees. So that's a significant portion of the population. Indian men and women, but mostly women, who make under $2 a day serving the institution. And that just didn't exist elsewhere. So I came as a kind of insider, but as a critical one who, you know, had a lot of critical theory background, and I was interested in post-colonial studies, and I thought, wow, this is an interesting dynamic here, right? That this institution that conceives of itself as based in solely in karma yoga, has this other group working for them in, and only in specific places. I found that in the Bahamas, they also have some native Bahamians who work in a similar role, but much smaller number of people. Certainly the majority of the work everywhere else in the institution, as far as I know, is done by karma yogis, as they call themselves.
What does your book argue? What's the hopeful primary takeaway?
Well, I think the takeaway, a major argument of the book, and it's there in the title, right, is that there, and that this, you know, this is not unique to yoga or to spiritual tourism, but there is a disconnect between the privileged few and the underserved majority. And in the context of yoga, that there's some hypocrisy there, right? I'll call it what I think it is, in that it's people who are conceiving of what they're doing as self-betterment and really about cultivating a global community and cultivating peace through yoga. And yet overlook in many ways the inequities of our global system, right? And in fact, many in this particular context, I think it's particularly interesting to look at it in the context of spiritual seeking, right? Because it really puts those two ends of the spectrum right in contact, right? That people who are in that mindset of speaking, seeking spiritual uplift through yoga, many times miss the inequities that allow them to have this quote unquote escape to India, right? Are foundationally based in other people's struggle. Is that a clear enough statement of my argument?
The questions are always meant to be generative, so we'll
yeah.
It's about the journey. this hypocrisy, that this scenario that you describe as hypocrisy, these blind spots, mm-hmm. whose blind spots are these? Are these the blind spots of the spiritual tourists at this particular ashram, or otherwise?
I think both. They are both the blind spots of individuals, because I think many of us who are privileged fail to see the ways in which we are, and I speak of that for myself as well. That it takes great work to learn to self-reflect on one's own privilege and to conceive of the ways in which it works for you. I think it's also structural and institutional, so that I'm certainly not in my book. This was a very loving critique of an institution that had shaped me as an individual, you know, that I was involved from a very young age. So it was core to my foundation as a person. Many of my teachers, you know, greatly respected in the institution, still. So it's not necessarily, you know, a blaming of the institution, but a calling all of us to sort of examine the ways in which privilege operates, but to suggest, you know, that if in a context like this, you know, with the greatest sort of highest spiritual aims, right, we don't achieve that, then how could we achieve it when we're just, you know, hotel hopping or, you know, doing other types of tourism, right? A lot of the same problems are there, but that even, you know, in the most aspirational settings, those inequities are really steep.
And so in this particular context, whose agency would ameliorate this problem immediately, do you feel?
Well, I think where I end in the book, and this, you know, this is always something I wrestled with, right? Is there a solution, and what would it be? And I think the big takeaways I had after spending my own time, you know, learning the language, sitting with and getting to know this group of people that I otherwise would not have encountered, that there are some simple ways that the organization could work to walk the walk of its talk, of its spiritual, you know, vision. And it wouldn't mean that every person taking a spiritual tourism trip to India would have to speak Malayalam, you know, well enough to communicate, you know, deeply with people, or, you know, to sit and spend their whole time sitting in the kitchen like I did, but that there might be some minor, like much more minor opportunities for people to interact, right? There might be programming, there might be opportunities for the women themselves, whose like many major daily conversations were about their body pain, to benefit from, you know, knowledge and lessons in yoga asana practice, right, that are being done right next to them, right? They're right there at this ashram, but there's somehow some mistranslation. So I think the agency I would look to would be in on behalf of the administration to cultivate more opportunities for people to connect, more visibility of the workers. You know, a big piece of what I talk about there is the blind spots, but it's also not you know, blind spots, when we conceive of them metaphorically, it's like just in your peripheral vision, right? So if you simply turned your head, you could see what's right there. And so I guess, you know, what I want to suggest is that it wouldn't be such a difficult thing to create those, you know, visions, that those connecting visions. If you like, so, I can tell you a story or an example from my...
You can tell me anything you'd like, anything you'd like. Mm-hmm. And then what I was going to ask, and you can feel free to either respond to this or tell the story first, as you wish. Mm-hmm. But what I was going to say, and obviously my questions are purposely naive and hopefully generative, but is this about raising awareness for better conditions for the worker? Or is this about raising awareness about better administration for the administrators in such tourist locations? Or if you could wave a wand, otherwise put, what would change?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In some ways, not directly my intention, but in some ways I do feel that my being there and my, you know, simply calling attention to the environment did call attention to the workers in ways that, in fact, like they did earn a raise during the course of my field work. I'm not sure if that was directly response to anything I did or said, although I was asking a lot of people a lot of questions, as anthropologists do. You know, there was some naive justification of, you know, workers being paid the going rate, the local going rate for that type of labor, that I felt were a little bit hollow in the context of such a wealthy institution. So, you know, there are aspects of the workers' conditions that I feel certainly, if I could wave a magic wand, I would have improved. But I also think that, you know, and as someone who came from inside this, you know, particular framework, you know, I was myself interested in yoga and the many benefits that I thought it could bring. Calling on spiritual aspirants, people in the West themselves, or not just the West, I mean, the institution often conceives of India and all its others as the West, right? But many of the spiritual tours now today come from East Asia as well, and many different parts of the world. But if I could also just bring awareness to those people, who insiders to this spiritual enterprise, right? To think about the spiritual as not just the self and one's own personal growth, but about one's relationship with others. That would be something that I would hope to bring awareness to and to shift. That may be asking too much, but that it was what it was a major takeaway for me.
Well, one wonders if it is not innate to classical Indic spiritual enterprises, classical darshanas, the process of however we conceive of that, enlightenment, moksha, given that such paths are typically predicated upon categorical precepts such as satya, himsa, asteya, etc.
Yeah.
Is it not innate to Indic personal spiritual growth paradigms to hold compassion and do right by others and treat others well? Is that not, that doesn't seem to be a disjunction?
Yes. Right. Yeah, I agree. And I think that, there's a lot of good writing in religious studies and that has suggested that this idea of spirituality oftentimes leads to a focus on the self or an individualistic approach. But I think more recent work has suggested that a lot of people who seek out the spiritual are also coming at it from a framework that would be supportive of social justice. And certainly it's not a disconnect, I don't think, to many of traditions within South Asia to think about working for the betterment of all.
Why else would spiritual gurus found ashrams?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so I mean, in some ways that's the easy piece of my argument, is that like this is what should be happening anyway. But it felt like it was a missed opportunity. I will give my example. I had an encounter at one point that comes up. I write about it in the book, with a group of European tourists who had somebody overheard me speaking Malayalam, and so they approached me very excitedly to could I please help them to communicate with some of the workers that they were trying to speak to, and I said sure, and I ended up talking with this group of European women, and they were trying to lobby on behalf of a stray dog, whose name was Shanti, who had just given birth to a litter of puppies, and they wanted to make sure that Shanti and her puppies were kept warm and dry, and they had actually organized funds to have Shanti's puppies get their vaccinations when needed, when they came of age, and then get spayed and neutered, right? So they organized this whole thing, very compassionate, wonderfully friendly attitude toward this animal, but they were having trouble because many of the women who cooked and cleaned there and had to access the closet where the storage supplies were and where Shanti had taken up to protect her puppies because it was rainy season. They were afraid of the dog. And so they didn't want the dog in the storage closet where they were keeping brooms and buckets and mops and such. And so the woman wanted me to translate and to communicate how important it was that this dog stay safe and dry and warm until its puppies could get released from her, get weaned and be able to get their vaccinations and move on. And it was just a perfect example of that disconnect, because the women, who were perfectly amenable to helping this dog and eventually did find a place that they can relocate the dog and her puppies to be protected. They themselves were living in homes that were often flooded by the rain. They were, barely making ends meet to feed their children. And there was no sense on the part of these ashram guests that they should lobby on behalf of those human beings to, you know, raise funds or to, you know, to help them get medical attention if needed. It was about the dog. And in fact, what they wanted me to translate was the need for the dog to get transported to her doctor's appointments after the ashram visitors, who of course were temporary, had vacated the ashram. And so it was, again, it was like a very sweet, warm gesture on their part to work on behalf of a suffering, as they perceived it, animal. And yet in many ways just missed so much of what they were asking these women to do, right? Take time off their lives and work to take a taxi to this faraway town to get the dog, and its puppies, their injections. But also, you know, not
well, the story's fine.
Yeah,
story is fascinating. It's a fascinating story on so many levels. There are some fascinating tales about dogs in Indic lore. What comes to mind is Yudhishthira entering the gates of heaven and insisting that his canine companion accompany him. But it fascinates me as sort of just a student of life and just I really don't know how I didn't do an ethnographic project, because I love speaking to people and learning about life, but. This, really, there's so much conditioning, cultural conditioning at play, in this meeting of individuals and cultures. Animals are interesting because different, you know, there's certain animals that one eats, and there's certain animals that you befriend, and this is different from culture to culture.
Yeah.
It would be akin, perhaps, somewhat akin to someone. Taking a spiritual stay in America somewhere and bringing to the attention of the staff that there is a pregnant raccoon out in the yard, and the staff's like, "Well, what? I'm sure there are hundreds of pregnant raccoons in this zip code alone, madam. What is your problem? Like, what do you want me to do for the raccoon? No, you need to make sure this raccoon squats in your pantry." Mm-hmm. And take the raccoon for and when I'm gone, you've got to take this raccoon to get medical care. And you're like, honey, have you seen me? I can barely afford my own medical care.
Right.
And so it's interesting. So the question that arises for me is, where's the compassion? Like, where's the compassion and the empathy for the person to whom you are speaking?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, anyhow, fascinating story. Is this work that you hope to continue in some way that you're still working on?
One doesn't know in the post-COVID era. I was planned to go back for the first time in a number of years, not since the research, but since 2013. I was planning to go back the summer of 2020. And so we all know what happened then.
2020. Wait, what happened in 2020?
So yeah, that would have been June or July. There was a conference I wanted to attend. And I was thinking about taking up with some of the newer activities that the ashram has been doing with Ayurveda and Ayurvedic massage. A couple of different things happened. Obviously, the COVID epidemic broke out in March around, right? And so that put a stop on any university affiliated travel for me. And I haven't been able to take that up again. But also in 2019, a prominent former member of the institution that I studied came forward with major allegations of sexual and psychological abuse. So this was in December of 2019. And after that, following on that, several others came forward and a large investigation ensued. And there's still, I don't think, any perfect clarity on the organization's cohesion between its different international parts and how they've reconciled with those allegations. But for me, it certainly put the brakes on my many of my connections there. So those two things happen really close together for me. And I haven't, so it's not a perfect answer, but I haven't really reconciled with what future research I have either in the yoga or Ayurveda, you know, healing realm, or in India specifically, beyond what I'm working on now, which is more about complementary and alternative medicine in the United States. So I haven't figured out where I go back to India.
Oh, it'll manifest as it always does. You know, we never in 1,000 years did I see myself, or did I even believe in the efficacy of online education. I've been teaching online since 2017, and I teach probably at 4 to 5 platforms, some credit, mostly non-credit. And so my long-winded way of saying, who knows what's coming next? You'll find out. Yeah. It may not be what you expect.
Yeah, that's great.
One final question for you. Who's your book for? Who might most enjoy and or benefit from your book?
Well, many people who I met over the years doing my research, who got to know in the context of yoga practice, and you know, tell them I'm working on a project, were like, I can't wait, you know, I can't wait to read your book. And in many ways, my book fails them because it is so much an academic book. So I hope they read it, and I hope they find something interesting in it. There are some accessible chapters, I think. But it's a scholarly work. It's for anthropologists and yoga studies scholars who want stories, want vivid examples of how some of these inequities play out that I think are undercovered, although in recent years there's been a lot of really great feminist and anti-racist scholarship on yoga at bringing attention to many of these inequities in modern yoga studies. But I think my work offers something unique in that it presents the voices of this group of Malayalam and Tamil speaking women who don't get to share their stories with this particular audience very often. So in some ways, regrettably, it's a book for academic scholars, anthropologists, modern yoga studies folks. But I also hope that some who are practitioners will read and will benefit from it, even if, you know, they skip some of the theory heavy stuff.
I've come to learn over the course really of my journey with an online school, created an online school. It's 2 years old-ish in a couple of weeks. Turns 2 in a couple of weeks, actually. But I've come to realize that there are tons of people who are super spiritual and super smart.
Yeah.
You know, some people are neither, but apparently some people are both. And so I find even among the practicing crowd, they're often interested in monographs and the latest research on yoga, et cetera, et cetera. It's fascinating. So yeah. I'm sure there will be a number in the audience who would enjoy and learn a great deal about this topic.
Yeah, I really hope so.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say or add before we close for today?
I guess I will say I feel really fortunate that I was introduced to yoga as a practice, as a path, and had an especially wonderful teacher early on in my studies who reassured me. It, like you just said, I think partly you made me think of that, right? Because that's kind of who I was, right? I was a spiritual seeker who was smart and was thinking critically about this stuff. And I'm really grateful to the many good teachers I had, but in particular, my teacher, whose name was Swami Atma, who, when I was wrestling with this topic early on, you know, in my 20s, trying to figure out, well, can I write about and be skeptical and critical of it while still drawing the many benefits that could be gained, or do I have to surrender completely my intellect? And he was like, absolutely not, right?
I was just thinking of some of my own teachers, and I'm wondering if there is any Indic wisdom teacher who says, give up your intellect.
Right. No, but you know what, Raj, there is a practice, and even as far as, like, Karen Ryan talks about this in her work, where, like, the Swami that she studied with makes this whole joke on her as an academic, right? Because he's like, the whole story about the shoe, like, there's, you step in something brown and it's stinky and you're picking it off from your shoe and you're like, you're an academic, so you're like, what is it? You know, blah, blah, blah. And then he's like, it's me. And I go, that's shit. And I just, you know, discard it, right? There is a, and that happened to me many times throughout my work, that people would see me, higher ups in the organization would see me taking notes. And I was like, oh, when is she going to just put her pen aside and, you know, like stop all her questioning mind, you know? There's both. I think there's the strong intellectual tradition within Indic traditions, but there's also in many places,
the transcendence of the intellect.
Yeah, exactly.
Or how I put it is, there are empirical modes, mm-hmm. and there are experiential modes.
Yeah.
And it need not be so esoteric as mysticism or religiosity. One can easily compare this to food or music, right? There's an experience that one has, and one typically, when one has internalized a piece of music and is performing it, one doesn't think about one doesn't think consciously about the scale or the key or et cetera, et cetera.
I guess I'll say I'm grateful that I had the right teacher, you know, to say, absolutely, right? It's all part of it. And especially that, you know, this organization gave me the trust and faith to do this work and write this book. So I'm grateful for that. And I guess that's what I wanted to end with.
Listen up, kids. Let me say for the record, if you're encountering a spiritual teacher who is advocating the dulling or the giving up of critical thinking, run for the hills.
Run. You're up to now, no good.
Having said that, certainly there's more to the mind than picking things apart. So anyhow, thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you. I appreciated the opportunity to speak with you and your great questions.
Great. For those of you listening, we've, of course, been speaking with Dr. Laura Kleppinger about her new fascinating book called Transnational Yoga at Work. Keep listening. Keep reading. And keep contemplating those in the margins and in the shadows of traditions and institutions, those who make it all happen for us. Seen or unseen. Take care.